Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 97, recorded December 2nd, 2010, The Dangers of 4G.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the AARP Auto Insurance Program from The Hartford. Discover great rates, benefits, and service specifically designed for AARP members at aarp.thehartford.com/podcast.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. And I don't know why I paused right there. Apparently, I'm just feeling very dramatic today. A lot of big news today. Rage HD coming out. We've got some good stuff going on with Verizon 4G. New SSD solid-state drives attached to USB 3.0, which means the ultimate transfer speed ever, I would suspect. Dogpile your viewer questions, and the man, the myth, the slightly late legend, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Are you with us, Mr. Shrout?
I'm here, but I'm only slightly late if you're watching live. If this is coming out on a podcast, I'm right on time. So,
clever.
I don't think that's a problem. I don't think that's a problem.
You lead taxer.
Yeah. If you guys want to watch this live, we record this at, as a gentle reminder to myself, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursdays, 6 p.m. Pacific, except for last week. We didn't do one last week. It was Thanksgiving. Everybody got the day off at in the Twit world. So I think we're okay with that. So let's jump into things. You mentioned it right at the beginning, the Kingston HyperX Max 3.0 USB 3 solid state drive. First off, I wanted to say, if anybody else was confused by it, I was as well. One of our storage editor, Alan at PC Perspective, actually did this review. But the brand of HyperX used to just mean memory to me. Like the Kingston HyperX brand was just their high performance system memory, you know, DDR2, DDR3 memory, that type of thing. But they apparently decided they wanted to carry that brand over into their other enthusiast class products, which external USB 3.0 drives or external SSDs in particular are definitely covered in that area. The unit itself is it's an external SSD that connects to your computer through USB 3.0. We looked at one of these a few weeks ago, or maybe a few months ago now, the OCZ Inyo, which is kind of an odd name to say out loud. But it was very, very slim, very sexy, very svelte. This is also very attractive looking. The finish, it's kind of got like a blue anodized aluminum type of look to it. Very small, basically almost the exact same size as a 2.5-inch hard drive, just a little bit longer. Because if you look at the pictures of the internals of this, it actually is just an SSD, like the bare PCB of an SSD with a little adapter at the end that has a serial ATA power and data connection that then outputs on the other end USB 3.0 connection. So it really does this, like there's like an extra PCB at the end of this that all it's doing is converting from SATA to USB 3.0.
It's essentially a giant, complicated USB thumb drive. I mean, it's a USB 3.0 thumb drive connected to it's a SATA drive connected to a USB thumb drive adapter. I mean, does it seem like a bizarre product, or does it seem like something that they engineered this so that it would be easy for them to upgrade to larger sizes as the memory chips density increased?
I think it's both, right? So this little adapter allows them to take essentially any controller, any flash memory, any capacity, and basically slap in this little adapter, put it in the same chassis, the same little aluminum metal casing, and ship it out the door as a different product. It's kind of smart because we don't really have any. I think there might be one available that is an actual NAND flashed USB 3 controller. Right now, all we have is NAND flashed to SATA controllers. So this kind of is, you know, like a little adapter on that. You know how sometimes you'll have a cable with maybe two or maybe three adapters on it to get it to the right place, just because this is what you have available sitting with you on your desk, and you really need to make this 6-pin FireWire into this little micro 4-pin, but you've only have, you know, the different adapters to go between stages. It's kind of like that.
Right.
In terms of performance, it does very well. It basically performs better than any USB 3.0 accessory we had tested to date. Let's see, we got burst speeds of over 200 megabytes per second, or right at 200 megabytes per second, sustained at 194 or 184 for reads and writes. It's a very, very high performance device, as you would expect. It's a Toshiba-based SSD. You know, it's next generation. It's their next generation controller. The Toshiba HG2 is the controller of it. This is actually the first time we have seen that controller, so it's kind of interesting there. We expect, you know, the actual standard 2.5-inch drive SSDs to be out basically any day now, based on that same controller. But performance is good. Pricing is also pretty good. Alan said that if you get the 128 gig model, we're right at about just over $2 per gigabyte in terms of real world purchasing.
So a mere $300 and change once you've picked up the sales tax on that, unless you buy it in Portland, in which case it's about what, $280, $290?
$280, he says, for the 128 gig model. So that's actually at or below the pricing of, you know, internal SSDs, right, as they are now, unless you find them on sale and all that kind of stuff that we talk about. But it's not a ripoff. In other words, it's actually a good deal. And if you know, if you have USB 3.0 on your PC, or you're planning on having it, you know, these are backwards compatible to 2.0. So if you needed a, you know, there's two types of external drives. There's people who want a fast external drive to move data back and forth between machines quickly, or you want a high capacity external drive for backup purposes. This isn't really a backup purpose unit, right? You know, don't ever use SSDs for that.
This is a moving your project, your big giant project between home and work. This is a boy, yeah, I really want 73 videos to take with me, you know, on the plane to, you know, China, but I've only got 40 minutes to load them all on there. This is for people who with modest storage issues who just want to be able to move everything really fast. I'm tempted to say this is an early, you know, early adopter. I am a super geek. I want a really cool toy. At least the pricing's not bad, though. It's like buy an SSD, get a USB 3.0 case wrapped around it for nothing.
What's funny is, yeah, you're exactly right. In fact, you could actually like take it apart if you wanted, mm-hmm, and you know, connect the SATA and power cables internally in your computer. You'd have just the bare PCB and stuff, so that's not necessarily the safest thing we could ever recommend to you, but it would work. You know, so technically you could switch this as an internal to an external drive, but maybe
at least until it broke.
Yeah, just be real careful with static and fan blades and all that kind of stuff when moving in and out.
So Rage HD, been talking about, people have been downloaded on the iOS for a while, and you actually got pretty serious with this back in QuakeCon. Tell us a little bit what's going on with the Rage HD first look you guys just posted.
So yeah, Rage is a game that's been coming out for, it seems like, ever.
Right.
This is basically the title that id started working on. It's right after Doom 3, I think. So that kind of puts things in perspective, if not immediately, right, very soon after Doom 3. And it's almost ready to be released on the PC and on the consoles and that type of stuff. But they actually, at QuakeCon, John Carmack went up on stage at his keynote, and mm-hmm, it's kind of a surprise to everybody, showed Rage, a version of Rage being played on an iPhone 4. Now, at the time, it was basically a still shot. I think he could rotate the camera around, you know, left and right.
Right.
And it looked really good for not just a mobile game, but an iPhone game, right?
Well, he was basically saying, look at how cool our engine is. Not only will it play on your $1,000 gaming PC, but we can scale it down to play on this wee little processor inside this phone that fits in your pocket. You know, and not be, you know, Wolfenstein circa 1989.
Yeah, and it's still impressive to look at. So if you're watching the video version of this, I've got it playing on my iPad here, and you can see. I mean, it looks good, right?
Absolutely.
In terms of actual gameplay, it is a on-rails shooter. So the most you can do is kind of rotate around in certain degrees, and you push the buttons at the bottom to fire. But the graphics are good. It's a huge download for your iPod or iPad. I think it's like 1.2 or 1.3 gigabytes when it's uncompressed and stuff. And that's mostly because of the, just the high quality textures and lighting maps and stuff that are at use or in use on the game. to me, it's really just, you know, take it or leave it for the game itself. It's an on-rail shooter, that type of thing, but it's only $2, first of all. So it's worth really trying out if you have an iPhone 4 or an iPad or something like that, just so you can, it's a good demo piece to show people who maybe don't know a lot about technology, say, hey, look what this little phone can do. It's pretty impressive to see. I don't know if you, I mean, I still am not sold on the idea of touchpad gaming. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, right? Have you played a lot of games on your iPhone? I know you have an iPhone 4 and that kind of deal. So it makes a lot more sense on the iPad to me, because when your thumbs are moving and tapping the screen to fire and stuff, they don't take up as high a percentage of the screen real estate. Whereas on the iPhone,
it's not too bad. I mean, I play a lot of like time wasters. You know, Flight Control, you know, Fruit Ninja, everybody else in the world, I have a copy of Angry Birds. Battle Bears is actually a first-person shooter. And when Battle Bears actually transitioned from the original control system to the both thumbs on the screen, it was an awkward transition. But the other thing I realized is I'm not somebody who lives and dies with a Nintendo DS. I'm not, you know, my PSP became a PS paperweight. You know, pretty soon after I started using it, because it was just, you know, it was just a device I didn't, a PS paperweight. You know, amazing piece of hardware with almost no practical use for anything I actually wanted to use it for. You know, the game, I just, you know, whatever. I actually do a lot of gaming, both with me and with my son, on the iPhone, because the iPhone's always with me and it's kind of like, it's my communicator. Everything's inside of there. So for me, it's actually pretty exciting to see what somebody like Carmack can turn out on that. And especially because, you know, Carmack's event horizon, you know, he's 5 years out. So he's already trying to figure out how to make, you know, the Apple processor do what he wants it to do. It's pretty interesting. You know, and it's, you know, aesthetically, like I want a Carmack type gaming experience on my phone. I just got to figure out a way to, as I'm sitting here looking at my phone, I just have to figure out a way to do it so that my phone, my son doesn't come obsessed with it like he did with, you know, Battle Bears, which is a bit much for a 3 year old, but he thinks it's the coolest thing to run the bear around on the screen and get his mayhem on.
I usually do that with the volume turned down.
I like it. Battle Bears guys, they're pretty cool people. I'm going to close it or else I'll start playing it and drive everybody insane. Yeah. While we're talking mobile, it's been really interesting, right? AT&T, the ITU, the international telephone, basically the international governing body of telephone standards, has basically decided, you know, up until you know, a few months ago or a few weeks ago, there was no true standard for 4G. It was a marketing term. And ITU's finally decided that there is a 4G and that no one actually is delivering 4G technology yet. And I bring that up because Verizon's launching Sunday this week, December 5th. They're launching their Long Term Evolution, their LTE, their 4G-ish technology, which goes on to compete with Sprint's WiMAX, which is essentially WiMAX is, you know, Sprint's 4G technology is essentially WiMAX. AT&T has their, you know, 3G and a half stuff. T-Mobile has their 3G and a half stuff. The ITU says none of it's 4G, but I think it's interesting because it's going to be $50 a month from Verizon. They're coming out with new phones, and a lot of people have gotten hands-on with the dongles and the phones recently. Sasha Sagan, PCMag.com's mobile tester, absolutely phenomenal mobile phone reviews and service reviews. but he got serious about testing the 4G LTE network. And the articles of a PCMag.com, 5 gigabytes, which is your entire monthly allotment for $50, 32 minutes.
Oops.
Yeah, and the pricing, right? The part of the reason there's data caps in most of the networks is to discourage people from using a lot of the data, right? That's why there's data caps.
Sure.
Or to discourage people from replacing their home cable modem with a 3G modem. Now, I don't think it's going to be as easy to download, you know, 5 gigabytes in a half hour in a few weeks, because right now there's like, I think, 8 people probably on the 32 cities and 60 airports, or 32 or 38 cities and 60 airports. airports that Verizon's lighting up on Sunday. But Sasha's test maxed out, he said, at 21 megabits per second. So
wow. That's way over actually, their like claim speeds, which almost never happens.
Yeah. He was actually hitting like 15 megabits per second. Verizon says they expect people to do about 8.5 megabits per second, but it still comes down to, you know, an HD movie and a half over iTunes, and you've destroyed your monthly cap. But you're looking at like literally like, you know, if you get some good healthy downloads, maybe an hour at Verizon's claimed speed, 44 minutes at the speed that Sasha was hitting. Right. And it's a really interesting thing to be aware of. I use a Sprint 4G modem. One of the nice things about that is I had an unlimited Sprint 3G account, which unfortunately is capped when you go to a 4G plan. And I think giving up my uncapped 3G modem may have been a mistake, but the 4G on that, at least the 4G downloads are actually uncapped. So I can download as much over the 4G network as I want to without incurring the wrath of the giant hit on my credit card. So something for for people to be thinking about as they're looking at dongles and phone service. It's kind of hard to hit 5 gigabytes on a phone, but a dongle on a computer, you can nail it pretty freaking fast.
I think one of the most telling things is I get in this discussion with a lot of people around here that think what are you going to do with 5 gigs? And maybe 5 gigs on your cell phone might be enough. But if you're talking about things like a Wi-Fi device and you're using it with your iPad or using it with your laptop, I mean, 7 hours of Netflix SD, you know, standard definition, 7 hours is all it takes to use up your entire 5 gigabyte allotment. For a 1 month period. And I think that kind of puts things in perspective, you know, even more. I mean, Netflix HD, you're like just under 3 hours. Yeah. Those are, you know, the 21 megabit, 32 minutes. That's if you're downloading a 5 gigabit or 5 gigabyte torrent file, congratulations. You know,
well, if you're watching like, but a few hours of Netflix, you know, 2 movies on iTunes, you know, a half dozen albums, you know, or probably, you know, more than a half dozen. But, you know, it's kind of funny. A lot of people realize when they bought their iPads, they got their iPad 3G, they got the service. And a lot of people found out that simply, you know, refreshing a single Facebook page can easily be 1 megabyte to 3 megabytes of data. So if you have a really minimal cap, you can blow through that cap pretty quickly. Oops, sorry about that. So it's kind of a, you know, for anybody that didn't get the unlimited 3G plan on their iPad, it's kind of a bummer for them. So it's something to be aware of as you're going into the holiday season, as you're looking at the shiny new toys. Just watch yourself on the data caps.
Yes, I am also a Sprint 4G user for that reason. They actually are just starting to turn on the 4G here in Cincinnati, but I definitely
it should be
use
on right
4G
now,
when
dude.
I'm out of
it's
town.
Ohio's
well,
on.
It is, like, but it's. I live south of Cincinnati, and it doesn't quite reach this far south of Cincinnati. I'm looking at the coverage maps going, it's like if I lived 3 miles farther north, that would be great. Unfortunately, I don't. So it'll get here. It'll get here.
I have a product for you. We'll talk about it later.
Before we get into our emails, questions from the audience, we want to thank our sponsor for today's episode. That would be the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford. For our audience members over the age of 50, the AARP Auto Insurance Program from the Hartford can save you as much as $384 on your car insurance. More than 3 million AARP members who are already enjoying the benefits of the program. Benefits that include lifetime renewability, a lifetime repair guarantee, and a 6-point claim guarantee. Customers who currently have this program describe the claims experience as fast, easy, and outstanding. You can check them out. Go to aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. That's aarp.thehartford.com/podcast. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Woohoo!
Indeed.
Eric has a question about SATA 150 and SSDs. He says he's looking to upgrade the hard drive in his white MacBook. I'm tempted by a 60 or 90 gigabyte SSD, solid state drive, in case you've been following along at home, but I think it may be too much for the SATA 150 in my laptop. Would I get similar performance from a WD Scorpio Black 500 gigabyte or similar Winchester rotating platter-based technology drive?
Winchester platter base. Nice.
Yeah, well, got to get the ancient rotating media reference in there. SATA 150, I don't think, boy, you know what I mean? Like SATA 150, I don't think people realize how big that pipe is. And, you know, you have this giant data pipe, SATA 150, you know, you have this huge amount of bandwidth for data, and your hard drive uses about that much of it. You know what I mean? I'd say he would see a huge performance difference between a Scorpio Black and an SSD.
He definitely still is going to see a performance difference. It's just people need to understand what the two levels of performance are in the hard drive still. It's like, so you've got your data throughput, right? So your megabytes per second. And SATA 150 maxes out at 150 megabytes per second, theoretical. Chances are your SSD would be able to perform higher than that. And maybe a Scorpio Black might be able to get close to something like that. But chances are really like burst speeds. And really we're talking probably closer to like 90 to 100 megabytes per second maximum, like the throughput. But the key is not the megabytes per second, but the milliseconds of latency, right? That's one of the things we always try to tell people. SSDs aren't going to blow away what hard drives can do in terms of megabytes per second today on most systems, because we're not really doing anything, unless you're doing like video editing and that kind of stuff, that uses a lot of throughput. But latency is what's key. How long does it take the operating system to find that one specific small file and access it and open it and bring it up on your computer? And that's what it's improved so greatly by SSDs is, you know, how long does it take an application to open? How long does it take your system to boot? How long does it take for all of your startup programs to load when you first turn on your computer? Those are the types of things that see vast improvements with solid state drives. You know, if you've got a Mac, how many bounces does it take of that little icon before the window shows up? And you ask somebody who's used a Mac for, you know, a long time, and all of a sudden you go from opening up iTunes and 12 bounces to 2 bounces, and that's like a noticeable, you can feel it while you're, you know, while you're using the system difference that you might not be able to put in a benchmark graph form. Right.
Presuming from suspend, right? When I took the SSD out of my white MacBook, the biggest thing I noticed was how much slower a 500 gigabyte Western Digital drive resumed from suspend compared to the SSD drive. That's the thing I missed the most. You know, file handling, opening applications, running stuff, very little of that I've noticed. But like every time I open up my notebook lid, I'm sitting here going, okay, I got a 12 count, and it used to be like that, and it was up. So, you know, thinking about that, you know, you almost might want to say, you know, if there's a big price delta between the drive, between the 500 gigabyte Scorpio drive, the Western Digital drive, and the SSD, you almost might want to say, take that money, put it in the I'm going to upgrade my notebook kitty and wait for later. Because if you leave your notebook open, you know, staring at you 24/7 and you rarely put it into suspend mode, you're not going to notice like the most attractive feature of an SSD, which is the reboot drive. If you don't work with very large files, if you don't work with big Photoshop files, big video files, you're not going to notice, you know, writing and opening those. You're not going to notice the impact of the SSD as much. Worthwhile upgrade? Yes. Just don't, you know, spend half the cost of a new notebook upgrade. And you're not going to with a 90 gigabyte drive. But, you know, there's so many other things that impact notebook performance, from, you know, the CPU, the amount of memory, the GPU, you know, the chipset that's powering it all, the amount of battery, how fresh the battery is. A lot of people, if they spend a lot of time carrying their notebook, if their notebook's 2 years old, it might be more useful for you to go buy a new battery for your notebook and get your original battery life back, because you've effectively, you know, after 2 years of running it down every day, you've just about worn out a typical notebook lithium ion battery. You might find it more useful to spend that money on getting a decent battery upgrade for that. So.
Right. Let's see. We've got another question here from David about choosing between a TV and a monitor. It says, "Hey, Twitch crew, been watching for a long time now and love the show. Been a fan of Mr. Norton." He called you Mr. Norton since the tech TV days. Nevertheless, the question is,
nevertheless, still had hair. Question, sorry. Yeah.
It'll happen to me eventually. The question is whether to buy a TV or monitor this coming Christmas. I'm willing to spend about $300 and I'm upgrading from a 20.1 inch BenQ flat panel widescreen LCD monitor that I bought about 4 years ago. From what I have seen on Newegg, it is a lot cheaper to buy an LCD TV for, say, $250 for a 32-inch, where if I bought a 32-inch monitor, it would be $350. That's not correct. First of all, I don't think monitors only 30-inch monitors are like over $1,000.
Yeah.
So we'll say like 27-inch monitor for that. He was wondering why the prices are backwards. In my opinion, seeing that a TV has built-in TV tuner, I would expect them to be more pricey. Yeah.
Okay. Well, as Ryan pointed out, a typical 27-inch, 30-inch flat panel monitor for your computer is typically going to cost $750 to $1,000, you know, maybe $500, depending on where you're shopping. I've seen a couple down around $350, but those are usually super specials. And they tend to have slightly better glass. They tend to be the high end of the range of the monitor manufacturers. I'm probably getting like the ultra sharp technology from Dell or something like that, and that adds up pretty much, or it adds up pretty quickly to a 27 inch piece of glass, a 30 inch piece of glass on a computer monitor. The HD tuners that go into televisions, HDTVs, one, a lot of HDTVs don't actually include them. Two, it's a commodity item at this point. It's something that probably costs about 50 cents, maybe a dollar or two. So it's not, you know, even if you do the like 5X, you know, from built in China to on retail in the US kind of markup formula, it's still a tiny percentage of the overall cost of the television. Here's the thing, right? If I've actually been playing around, we're in the process of Texilla, my little test area for Texilla is moving from a cubicle in the main offices over to the workshop in the studio. So I've been sort of stuffed into this little corner area, and instead of using a 24-inch monitor, I've been using a 42-inch LCD flat panel as a screen. And the two things that come to me is, one, I'd like higher resolution on the screen, and two, it actually worked a lot better than I thought. The trick is to get it, you know, far enough back that you're not looking like this when you're trying to read a document, which sounds really silly until you've actually seen a Word document spread across a 42-inch flat panel. So you kind of ended up narrowing everything down and putting it in the center and putting, like, you know, your tweet deck and your other applications off in the corners. You know, here's the thing. The LCDs LCD flat panels, they're more commodity items. They're printing a huge amount of the glass. They had better be 1080p for the money you're spending, because a 720p monitor is going to look – 720p is great for a television behind a bar that's 12 feet away from you. If you've got something – if your monitor is within arm's reach, the Kell factor says the closer the monitor is, the higher the resolution it needs to be for it to look good. Or conversely, the higher the resolution is, the closer you can get to the monitor with it still looking good. So, you know, you're going to look for 1080p. I think you're going to get slightly better glass on the computer flat panels. I think you're going to get a better price on a lot of the, especially around this time of year, people are going to be digging out a lot of crap out of the warehouses and pricing it cheap. But I'm guessing like Dell outlet for a really nice 22-inch monitor is going to be about $200. A really nice 23-inch monitor is going to be about $275. That's the Dell Ultra Sharp technology. You know, if you want a TV, I'd buy a TV, get the 32-inch one. For a 32-inch monitor that's going to be across the living room from you, 720p is fine, but I would get 1080p if you can, just to have it as more and more online programming comes on in 1080p. But yeah, mostly though, they build more 32-inch televisions than they do 32-inch monitors, ergo the price being cheaper on the televisions. So. Right.
Yep,
that's my thought.
I agree. It's one of those misconceptions that people need to figure out how to wrap their head around. It's like, well, I don't understand how my 42-inch TV is so much less than my 30-inch monitor. It's like, yeah, they're very different in what you can do with them. Just trust me. Mm-hmm. we've got an email from Joel who asks about Passmark as a test. He says, I often use Passmark. Passmark provided benchmarks of CPUs and GPUs from a website, cpubenchmark.net. to compare products I'm looking at purchasing. I've even tried their software myself, and it seems like a nice product. This seems like the only good site where you can compare any CPU or GPU in a big index. However, I haven't seen any PC hardware sites like PC Perspective use this software for benchmarking. Do you guys have any experience with Passmark? Is its benchmarking software displaying accurate results when compared to something like 3DMark? And I had heard about Passmark before. We'd seen it run a few times. We don't use it at PC Perspective, and the reason for it is pretty simple. It's a very simplistic test, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's one of those synthetic tests that can only show you so much information, right? So it runs a whole bunch of tests, and then it will give you one number at the end. And you can break it down into CPU tests, 2D graphics, 3D graphics, disk memory, and then optical drives. But the 3D tests are not very modern or very current, so we wouldn't use them for comparing GTX 580 cards and 480 cards that really require a lot more heavy-duty computing to really be stressed enough to do accurate comparisons. You know, the CPU tests, they do mathematical operations, compression, encryption, SSE instructions, those types of things. They can give you good synthetic processor comparison numbers. That's worthwhile. We try to use as few synthetic benchmarks as possible in terms of benchmarking for processors and graphics cards. We try to use more real world applications. So we'll do a lot of video encoding, audio encoding, things like that, playing real games for the graphics card tests and that type of thing, because I think it gives a better impression to the consumer of what's the actual difference between $300 here and $500 here. You know, if you get a score of 1200 and a score of 900, yes, there's a difference, but what's that actually mean to you in applications and in real world scenarios?
It's kind of like when people do sort of like, I am overclocking Guru and I am overclocking this CPU to 8,000 megahertz. And it's like, that's awesome, dude. But, you know, you're using a copper pipe and you're using, you know, liquid helium and you happen to have access to, you know, a particular lab environment. Or maybe you're just pouring liquid nitrogen on it in the garage and hoping the entire thing doesn't seize up. But synthetic benchmarks are great for going, hey, it's got 4,000 more weasel marks than this CPU does. I'm not trying to diss Passmark when I say weasel mark. It's just weasel is kind of my, you know, adverb, adjective of choice. You know, is the CPU going to be faster? Yeah, on Passmark, which is why Ryan's running real world benchmarks. So I can be like, hey, you know, it gave us this many more frames per second, or it was capable of running with every anti-aliasing, you know, feature turned on at 1920x12. You know what I mean? It's the only really great benchmark is the one that emulates what you're actually doing on your machine. If something does great on a 3D gaming benchmark, that's probably a sign that it'll be a great, you know, CPU or, you know, CPU combination or a great CPU for running video editing on, but it's not the same as going, wow, you know, by changing this thing and loading this driver and putting that piece of hardware in, I was able to render my video 20% faster.
Sure. Yeah.
Because, you know, you ideally you want to test with the applications you use and care about every day.
And that's why we try to give a wide range of benchmarks. Now, I do want to say, before we just leave this topic, the website itself, cpubenchmark.net, does have some interesting data on it. Even if you're, you know, if you keep in mind that these benchmarks are synthetic in nature and they're not going to be exactly, you know, precisely helpful. If you go there and you click it, like the high-end CPUs, that gives you a good listing of how a bunch of processors score compared to each other. And you can use that as a quick data point. One of the things that I thought was interesting is if you click on one of these processors, like if I click on an AMD Phenom 2 X6 1075 processor, one of those 6-core processors, it gives you, it kind of gives you what its general score is. It gives you its score per dollar, right? And it actually has a graph of pricing history over time. So it actually, I don't know how it's doing it. It's using multiple pricing schemes, I assume. But it'll let you track the price of that processor over time, which is something that's kind of cool to see in graph form. They also provided a really good information in one of the bottom most graph is AMD versus Intel market share. And I'm guessing this is based on how many performance test results they are getting over the years. And they have results all the way back to 2004. What's interesting is if you look at Q1 of 2006, it's like 50-50. Intel's and AMD were like, you know, 50-50. Right. Now it's like 22% to 78% in favor of Intel. So you saw that gap through 2008, 2009 really, really shoot up there. So,
like, I mean, the Core 2 Duo really changed a lot of stuff. And then the Core i7 just opening up a performance gap. Although I got to say, I'm running with a couple of AMD systems in the lab right now. And I'm very happy with the performance, especially on home theater boxes. So good stuff. Ethan writes in, he says, "Hey guys, I love the show and I try to listen whenever I can, so I need your help again. I'm planning on doing my first PC build. I'm 15 in December or January, and I was wondering, should I build in December or wait until January when the new CPUs come out, if I remember the release date right? Would the price drop on the current generation of parts be a lot or not worth the wait? Thanks for the help." Wait.
It's always better, right? I mean, especially if you know you're this close. Like Intel's already said, we're going to release new parts. Like, not an end of January. We're talking like January 5th or 6th, or right around CES time frame, right? So we're almost exactly 30 days away from that.
Wait.
Yeah. I would say wait. As for the price drops, it's hard to say. It was interesting because when the Core i7 processors first came out, the price drops on the Core 2 Duo and Core 2 Quads weren't that dramatic because so many people had those motherboards and were wanting to upgrade their processors. The prices stayed fairly high for a good amount of time because the adoption rate for Core i7 wasn't quite as quick. And I would be surprised if that's much different this time around. I think Sandy Bridge is going to be a great product. I haven't had a whole lot of hands-on time with it yet, but I think it's going to be a great product. I think the adoption rate will be a little bit slower in the DIY market than in the system and notebook market.
Yeah, I will say, Ethan, if you buy the CPU next week and Sandy Bridge comes out and it drops 20 or 30%, you know your Core i7 or your Core i5 or whatever you're looking at drops like 25% when the Sandy Bridge CPUs come out, you're going to be really pissed and you're going to be thinking like, I could have bought 5 games, or I could have bought, well, 3 games, or, you know, I could have bought more memory, or could have bought an SSD instead of a rotating hard drive. It kills, but have a little patience. Plus, sometimes you'll find some really amazing deals in January because retailers are looking around and they're going, okay, so we just did like 50% of the year in November and December for retail sales because that's the way it works here in the United States. Let's throw a sale and see if we can get anybody's Christmas money. And Ethan actually had a pretty good follow-up question. Could you guys give me a good comparison of an ATI AMD graphics card versus an NVIDIA graphics card in the $200 to $250 range? Basically, he wants gaming and some minor Photoshop, which basically means he wants the best GPU for gaming between $200 and $250.
I'd say there's great options for both of those. If you go to this wonderful website, I know it's what's the name of it?
PCPer.com?
Yes, yes. If you go to the graphics card section there, there are like articles, probably 2 or 3 in the last month, that look exactly at cards in those price ranges. Look for reviews of the Radeon 6870, 6850, and the GeForce GTX 460. Those are the three cards that you should probably be comparing in that $200 to $250 price range. And it's going to be really close. I think 6870 and 50s versus the GTX 460s is really going to depend on a bunch of other stuff we won't get into here. But check out those data. Check out those articles and the data in there. So
David wants to know why Atom CPUs have 64-bit support. He writes in, "Love the show. I was recently looking at the new Dell Inspiron Duo, which has the Atom dual core N550 running at 1.5 gigahertz. According to Intel specs, it has a 64-bit architecture, but in the listing, it also says max memory size, depending on memory type, is 2 gigabytes. So what's the real deal? Is it really 64-bit? If so, is the hardware limited on memory allocation? Of course, that statement in the documentation is a bit fuzzy. Thanks, guys, for any light you can shine and maybe what your thoughts are on the chipset. Rock on." Well, yes. On one hand, I can absolutely say quite happily that Intel's Intel's Atom processors are crippled in memory size, and they do that to protect the sales of their other processors.
You know, that kind of sucks, but it is what it is. 64-bit processing, you know, the most obvious benefit of moving to a 64-bit architecture is having a relatively unlimited amount of addressing space you can look at in memory. The side benefit also, it changes the word length for the amount of bits that the CPU can process in a single clock cycle. So, you're, you know, the kind of an oversimplification, but you cram more bits. You know, every time the CPU cranks over once, you can stuff more bits on it in a single pass of the clock. Anything we would add to that, Ryan? Am I oversimplifying?
No. You're right that the most important feature is addressable memory space, but there are 64-bit operating systems, there are 64-bit instructions, right. And this just allows the processor the ability to run those. So, without 64-bit support, it couldn't run Windows Vista X64 and right. maybe... You know, a bunch of applications that are coming out using 64-bit processing instructions as well. Right. So, I mean, they definitely are 64-bit processors. Yes, they also have maximum addressable memory size of 2 gigs, which is, you know, it's dumb, but it's also, it's an Atom processor. It's like, do you really, really want to put 8 gigs of memory on an Atom processor? Probably not. If you're doing it wrong, if you do that, right. So... Yeah, so there you go. We got an email from Chris about the Alienware M15X. Do you have experience with this laptop, Patrick, before I get into it?
I have more experience with the 11 than the 15.
Okay. Close, though.
Close. I actually have a number of hours logged in on the 11X from Alienware, which is a wonderful, super small gaming notebook. It's sort of a gaming netbook.
Right. he says,
I'll let you read Chris's question, though.
He says, first off, love the show. Keep it up. He's looking to buy a new laptop for gaming and school soon. He's looking at the Alienware M15X. First question is, do you guys have any experience with this laptop? How does it fare? Second question is about upgrade options for the laptop. The model he's looking at comes with a Core i7-740 quad-core processor, 512 meg GeForce GT240M, 6 gigs of memory, a DVD burner, 512 gig, 7200 RPM hard drive. Now, for upgrades, he's listed some upgrade prices, and he wants us to know if we think they're worth the upgrade price. So he moves... Like a Core i7-840 is $325 extra.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say no on that one.
I would say a big no.
Video card, he can go to a 1 gig Mobility Radeon HD 5850 for $150 or a 1 gig GeForce GTX 260 for $250. Those are both fairly significant upgrades over the GeForce GT240M. Memory capacity, yeah, that's also an improvement. But both of those are much faster GPUs. If he's doing gaming, then I would say the HD 5850 for $150 makes more sense to me than the 260M upgrade.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems more reasonable to me and will definitely give you a noticeable boost in gaming performance. Upgrade to 8 gigs of memory... For $150.
No.
Yeah, we're talking going from 6 to 8 for $150. No, that's not worth it. Blu-ray drive for $150.
If you want to watch Blu-ray movies, it's going to be cheaper than buying a full-size Blu-ray drive and an external enclosure and hooking it up over USB 2.0. I love Blu-ray, but Blu-ray on a 15-inch monitor. If you have a HDTV in your dorm and you can connect it to, then Blu-ray starts to make a little sense. And then the hard drive upgrade options. $150.
Go ahead.
Not for you.
$150 for the 128 gig model, or $525 for the 256 gig model. The first thing I was going to point out is that it's $150 for 128 gigs or more than three times that price for just twice as much data. So definitely don't go the 256 gig model. The 128 gig is not a bad price for that capacity. because of the benefit you have of, you know, they're replacing another hard drive and giving you some credit for that. Mm-hmm. They don't really, he doesn't mention what type it is. And my guess is they probably don't even tell you what type of SSD it is.
Whatever they got cheapest that day.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, not to be a smart aleck, but I mean, it's whatever they get the best deal on. That's part of the reason they don't name the price or name the brand. It gives them a whole bunch of flexibility.
I'm almost tempted to say not to have them do the SSD, but instead, you know, get your system in, use it for a little while, or just buy an SSD from Newegg or Amazon or wherever. You know, get a 128 gig model. Maybe you'll pay $200-$225 for it, maybe a little bit more than that. But when you replace it, you'll have this 512 gig hard drive that you took out of your Alienware machine, and you can put that in an external enclosure. Now you have a nice portable hard drive as well. Yeah. So you get a little bit of benefit out of that, and you're going to get, I think, a better overall value, like in total, for the two drives that way. But I could go either way on that.
I would also say I would also take a close look. You know, part of me loves, I particularly like that M11X, which is their smaller version, because it's a very unusual design. It's got some really interesting stuff done for people who spend a lot of time under battery power, not gaming, that allows them basically turning off the NVIDIA stuff. I'd also say, you know, you're a college student, you know, you may want to save, like, you know, I look at $525 for a 256 gigabyte SSD drive, and I think about, like, you know, a year's worth of, well, not today, but I think about a whole bunch of concert tickets. I think about, that's probably your entire year's worth of book money right there. A whole lot of food that didn't come out of the cafeteria in the dorms. you know, I would take a look at
real world perspective. I like it, Patrick.
Well, you know what I mean? Cause like, I love Alienware, right? They make these crazy, like, wow, we really, really like the Giger set, you know, the Giger alien design sets, from the Alien movies. But take a look at the XPS line from Dell, which is the same delete expletive stuff inside the computer with a different case. You know, what markup are you paying for that shiny Alienware exterior on your notebook? You know, the other thing is, I got to say, is, you know, for, you know, you could also buy an inexpensive notebook that you're trucking around every corner of the campus, and take the money you're not spending on a gaming notebook and build a pretty badass gaming PC that you'll actually be able to upgrade and keep using between now and your senior year of college. Because my issue with gaming notebooks is, if you're not made of money, your gaming notebook's probably going to be great for this year. Maybe it's going to be okay next year. By year three, you're going to be like, I can't play the new games on this. How much money did I spend on this notebook? So that's just an issue I personally have with gaming notebooks. You spend a lot of money for less performance than you get out of a desktop, and you pay more money, considerably more money than you would pay to get the same performance out of a desktop. Just say it, man. Yeah. We got some Blu-ray to MKV answers.
We did. I think it was not last week, because we didn't do a show. The week before, in our last episode, we had a question about how to convert from Blu-ray to MKV. And I think neither of us had a whole lot of experience doing that.
No.
But we got some good feedback in from quite a few emails, and I just picked out a few to throw in here from a few different vantage points. The first one came from Jordan, who said that he would suggest RipBot 264 along with any DVD HD. He converts his Blu-rays and HD DVDs to 8 gigabyte MKVs, which he then puts on his Atom-based DLNA media server running MediaTomb. He uses a WDTV Live, a Western Digital device, WDTV Live, to watch all of his content. Personally, I can't tell any difference between the source discs and the 1080p MKVs. It's the best solution I've come across yet.
Cool. Neil said, I've tried almost everything. If you want to rip DVD and Blu-ray, use makemkv.com. It works awesome. If you want to take that file and transcode it into anything else, use Super C, hands down, the best format transcoder. You can do almost anything with it. Both software packages are free. I transcode stuff to run on my PlayStations and my Roku all the time using these tools.
Also very cool. And Nathaniel said, If you want a one-to-one backup of Blu-ray MKVs and have any DVD HD running, do the following. He has a quick list here. Browse to the BDMV playlist folder. Drag the playlist you want to an application called TS Muxer, which is from a place called smlabs.net. Use the demux option to demux the M2TS and to the HD. Right. So this is when things get confusing, right? You get all these mux things that you have to do, combining formats and audio and video and this type of thing. And then he has dragged the demuxed files to the MKV tools MKV merge, which I think was the same. No, it was make MKV in the first one. This is MKV merge. And then complete any format specific options, such as if you want to change the frame rate or something like that. And right. Start the muxing to create an MKV. So that's a much more complex option, but allows you to get apparently a one-to-one backup of a Blu-ray disc completely, not just one track or one movie portion of it. So yeah, I mean there's a lot of different solutions out there. Apparently we've got several other ones, but I just wanted to throw a few out here. It looks like any DVD HD is kind of like the most popular solution. Yeah. To get that running, so
any DVD HD is a phenomenal application. They work on it constantly. It's an expensive application, especially if you wanted to use the lifetime upgrade option. I want to point out that any DVD basically is getting rid of the lifetime updates. You're basically buying the use of any DVD for a year now. They do have a lifetime upgrades offer, but it is going away as of December 31st, 2010 is the last day you'll be able to buy that lifetime upgrade. They are giving you a 20% discount on it. So, you know, they want to encourage people who want the lifetime upgrade to get it now. But, you know, you're talking about $114 for the lifetime upgrade, just as a heads up to people. Phenomenal, amazing application. If you plan to spend the rest of your life, grabbing Blu-ray videos, it's well worth the money in terms of not spending a lot of time yanking your hair out trying to figure out how to make archival copies of Blu-rays. Just saying, do us a favor, don't steal content you don't own. But if you are going to archive Blu-rays you own, any DVD HD is a phenomenal package, and the lifetime upgrade on that is going away at the end of this year. Agreed. Twitch, oops, sorry.
No, I was saying I agree. Look into it.
9 p.m. Eastern Standard, 6 p.m. Pacific, live.twit.tv is when you can catch us taping Twitch this week in Computer Hardware Live. If you want to email us, we love your emails, Twitch, T-W-I-C-H, at twit.tv is the email address. And if you're trying to figure out where you can download this show, and if you don't know where to download it, I'm not sure how you found it, but I'm glad you did. Go to twit.tv/Twitch, T-W-I-C-H. Spelling is going to be my big goal in 2011 as far as my resolution goes. Everybody, thanks for watching. We are so pleased you came out to see us tonight. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv.